So today, we are gathered here for, what should I call, for some Dharma discourse and discussions. This is the second day of our gathering. So first of all, the cultural tradition in general, and particularly the glorious Nalanda spiritual tradition, which is demonstrated through logic and reasoning, as I said yesterday, in today's world, this tradition has the potential to an opportunity to serve the world. So since we have the potential and the conditions for that, doing that, it is worth to endeavor to do that. Why? Because today in this world, right now, we are very peaceful here, but in other parts of the world, there are human beings who are seem like us, thousands of them are being murdered, and millions are at the risk of starving to death. So this is really unfortunate. In the last few days, in England, there was murderous assassination of people, attacks. And then in other parts of the world also, this happens. These are all human, done by humans. So as I said yesterday, the basic nature, one of the students said, according to Darwin's the theory of evolution, human nature is evil. But in our childhood, in most cases, the children were more smiley and cheerful, but human beings killing other human beings and abusing others and causing ruin to others, we need to think whether these can be these are matters which can be solved. Of course, there is a solution to these problems. Why? Because if we could promote and spread the love and compassion, then the evil actions carried out due to lack of love and compassion to others can be overcome. For example, in India, there's corruption, under-table dealings, and also caste system, which because of which there's big discrimination. And I usually tell the Indian friends, my Indian friends, that historically India is a religious country, and ahimsa, or non-violence, for thousands of years, over 2 to 3,000 years, India has been promoting it. And today, 1.2 billion or so population of India, I mean, generally speaking, of course, we can see the peace and coexistence in India, and all the major religious traditions of the world coexist in this country peacefully. So this is related to India's tradition of nonviolence, ahimsa. So this is what I usually make clear to the Indian friends, and this religious harmony amongst the different religions, and however small it may be, there is greater peace and less killing of human beings by human beings in India. And this is an example regarding us Tibetans, the children are usually here, hear that they should not kill insects. So even though they may not be given lots of reasonings, but the life of these insects should be respected and not killed. And so we don't trample life. So some time ago, one Tibetan administration official went to America, and he started working in a refectory of a college or university, cleaning vegetables. And when he was cleaning vegetables and found insects and the certain animals or worms on the leaves, he would collect them in a bowl, and then after he finishes cleaning the vegetables, he would take the bowl of worms to a very safe place. And his co-workers were telling him that this is an extra work that you are doing. And then he explained that in our custom, in Tibetan tradition, we have this habit of not harming life. And therefore, gradually, his co-workers, Western Americans, also started picking the worms and from the leaves and collecting them in bowls. And so this is an example again that one person respecting life, not killing even worms, doing this could actually, when one Tibetan person practices it, this has actually caused others to do the same and left a good impression in others, and they started doing it. And so we as Tibetans could also do something that can influence others around us. And so as exiles, we Tibetans number 150,000 or 200,000, around 200,000, 150,000 in India, and then the rest in the other parts of the world. And so if we could actually spread this kind of practice of respecting life to others, we Tibetan people as a people could be exemplary to others or role models. And I met American who was involved in taking 1,000 Tibetans to America, who told me that the reason why he was involved in taking Tibetans over to America is not because of some kind of attachment to Tibetans, but because he thought that if the good habit of the Tibetans could be the compassionate and loving nature of Tibetans could also spread amongst the American people, it would be helpful, he thought. And then in India also, in the Tibetan settlements, in different parts of the country, many of the local Indian authorities praise the Tibetans in the areas. They told me that they find the Tibetans to be really humble, ethical, whether it's in Orissa or Mysore or Karnataka or Bandra. So when I meet the Indian authorities, they tell me such things about Tibetans, which is very good, isn't it? But there was one case are in Kulu Manali area, some altercation between Tibetans and the local Indians, and some of the local Indians were saying at that time that in the Tibetans who came in the 60s and 70s to India were very good, but then over the years they have worsened. So this is a lesson that we should learn from them. If we are not careful, the good nature that we have, the tradition, the customs, would decline and dwindle, and then more competitive sense of competition and jealousy and abusing others, trying to deceive others would increase. Of course, this is everywhere in the world. And so we could also be influenced by these. And so that we could lose the moral principle that we have been passed down, that has been passed down to us from generations, would die, go away. So the best thing not to be influenced by others is not to remain isolated. That's not the way to go about. In Latin America, for example, and other places I visit, I have met with the indigenous people, and who are worried that their tradition, customs would decline if they interacted with the people in the world, in this hectic world, and therefore they want to live in isolation. And I've told them that this is wrong. So because of your fear of losing your own tradition, if you remain isolated, you would be at the losing end, I told them. And then I gave them example of people in Scandinavian region, the people in Norway, and this in Norway there's a Sami land. I have many friends from that region. So the people of Sami land are educated like other Norwegians. They go to school and finish their schools. While doing that, they are able to preserve their own costumes, language, and other traditions. So they have been able to keep up with their own tradition, and they have also their own parliament. So they are able to go on par with modernity while keeping their own tradition intact. So I told these people that while you have modern education, you should also be able to keep up with your own ancestral or tradition. So for us Tibetans, after coming into exile, in the beginning, of course, the first thing we were involved in was to preserve our own language and cultural tradition. So this was our concern, so that our tradition language doesn't decline. So that was our first concern. And the method of doing this is by having and educating our children in a modern education. And therefore, we started the Tibetan secular schools. I reached Missouri in April 1959. And then in 1960, we first set up the first Tibetan school in Missouri. And therefore, our own tradition and culture and our philosophical tradition should be preserved through education, of modern education. And for that reason, we requested the then Indian Prime Minister Nehru to set up schools separately for Tibetans. And so he also set up the Central School for Tibetan schools for Tibetans. So since then, it's been now 57, 58 years that we have done the preservation of our own tradition, culture, religion, and so forth, and we have actually become a unique refugee community. But still, we are not able. We have not been able to fulfill our goals fully. So we need to make improvements over what we have, so that we would be able to accomplish our original goal, what goal we had set then. For example, in the case of the debate in those days, in the 60s, when the Tibetan schools were set up, there were in the schools there were many students who were able to debate quite well. For example, the late principal who was killed by the followers, Genlofen-Gyatso, was one of those teachers who taught debate. And at that time, I also debated with him in Missouri. And then in Shimla and Dalhousie CST schools, there were students who could debate quite well, but then it declined. This tradition in the schools kind of dwindled, and then we also had this suggestion that these different subjects, if it would be good to teach the different subjects in our own language. So in the last few decades, so this tradition and the religious tradition that we have, contribute to the world through our so we should, as Tibetans, should be the people who lead in this venture to serve the world through our own religion, culture. And so in the praise to the 17 Nalanda masters, at the end of the 17 Nalanda masters praise, as everyone has this, that's text. At the end, there is the colophon. Look at the colophon. It's in Tibetan. The Tibetan is on page 5. So in the colophon, I've written all the marvelous explanation of the profound and the vast teaching of excellently revealed by the Lord Buddha, which were composed by these scholars from the noble land of India, can open the eyes of intelligence in anyone who has discerning awareness, that these teachings are still being studied, reflected, and meditated upon today, and have not diminished after almost 2,550 years, is due to the kindness of these great scholars. I therefore composed this prayer to remember their kindness and with unwavering faith aspire to follow in their footsteps. So with an unwavering faith aspiring to follow their footsteps doesn't mean that we just study this text alone, And what we study also are other subjects which are included in the five major and five minor sciences. And in the five major sciences, one of them is the inner science of Buddhism. So regarding this, through the study of Buddhist philosophy, and particularly studying about psychology that is found in our literature, it is something that can that is really practically helpful to us. So it's not like grammar, studying grammar or where we learn the formation of words and so forth, but Buddhism has to do with transforming, relating to our own mind and transforming our mind. It's not just getting rid of our ignorance alone, but by making transformation within our mind so that this unruly mind goes away and we become more disciplined and have more peace and calmness and relaxed state of mind, devoid of any anxiety, fear. But here, relaxation doesn't mean not thinking about anything, but being discerning, having this discernment to overcome the causes that give rise to anxiety, fear, and so forth. So in connection with this psychology, and this teaching of Buddhism is like medicine to overcome our disease in the mind. And so I've usually been talking about taking care of the hygiene of emotions, just as we have. We do take care of the physical hygiene of our body. So in the hygiene of mind, what we need emotions, what we need to do is to decrease those factors which give rise to anxiety, fear, and all these negative emotions, and by promoting the positive factors. So the writings of these great masters of Nalanda we remember and I have unwavering faith in them to aspire and aspire to follow in their footsteps. At this time when the whole world has witnessed tremendous advancement in the fields of science and technology, but we are also greatly distracted by the hustles and bustles of our hectic lives. As we all know, in India also, and particularly in Dharamsala, for example, in the beginning when we came here in 1960, it was a very small village. So, in April 1959, I reached Missouri, and at the end of March, I reached India, and then stayed in Missouri from April for 1 year. And then the Indian government told us that Missouri was just a temporary station that they have prepared for us. But Nehru told me, at that time when we hear about moving to Dharamsala, we were hearing that Dharamsala is a place where there is greatest, the heaviest rainfall in India, one of the heaviest rainfall, and Kundaling was sent here to check. And then he came here and returned to Missouri, and he said, Dharamsala is a very good place, he said. And he said this, Dharamsala water is tastier than Missouri milk. So this is what he said. And therefore, we moved to Dharamsala. Of course, it was a very small and poor village. And there was only this shop of Naruji and some other shop. So it was a very poor place. And it was very difficult to contact people in Delhi. And the electricity there was also very poor. So how much development and progress has there been in Dharamsala, you can see. So this will still continue. And although materially we have made progress with so many shops and restaurants and hotels, and the communication and contact with other people are much easier, but have people's happiness increased or what? We need to check this. So in Europe and America, the more material development there has been, there it's not sure that there is greater happiness. We can see this. So through modern education, there has been material progress and development, but so it is quite clear that material development alone cannot bring us real happiness and peace of mind. Of course, we need material development progress, but this alone is not sufficient. This is very clear. For example, in China, Deng Xiaoping started this policy through which, on the basis of which, there has been lots of economic development and progress. People's economic conditions have become better. And then there has been corruption, due to which there is now a big gap between the poor and the rich. And the poor are without help. And so material development alone doesn't help, does it? So China is supposed to be a socialist country, which means that the government's main job is to look after the poor people, needy people. But if you lack the sense of morality and principle, then the poor people remain poor and they are not looked after. So to be a true to the spirit of socialism, one needs to dedicate for the welfare of others. However good a system may be, if that system, the people in that system, working in that system, lack morality, and externally, however good things may be, the rules and regulations maybe doesn't help. And so, in connection with psychology and emotions, to promote love and compassion, to have a compassionate nature, is the source of our happiness. And so, as I said yesterday, the basic human nature is compassionate. It is clear in the world, the whole world is that the whole world is lacking in this compassionate principle. Because of this, animals in the wild and also cattle and so forth, the domesticated objects.
Okay.
Suiza. Some kind of a sponsor or something. I don't know.
As I always
mentioning,
you Indian.
So he's on
historically,
the Indian
traditionally, our guru, we are chela. So we learned ancient Indian knowledge. Over 1,000 years, we kept all this knowledge. So now here today, I am sort of as a messenger of ancient Indian knowledge. So actually, wherever I go, I always talk about inner value, love, compassion, forgiveness, these things. And 1,000-year-old India's tradition, Ahimsa. Ahimsa very much related with karuna. Where karuna there, wisdom there, then ahimsa automatically come. Without the sense of compassion and without wisdom, then sometimes you say ahimsa may not be much effective. So wisdom, warm-heartedness, the pranja, wisdom, the karuna,
Krishna Kapoor.
Then you see Krishna Kapoor. Individual life become happy life, meaningful life, and you can share with more people. So now in this respect, India have great potential to make some contribution for peaceful world, or compassionate world. So, thank you. I often used to telling my Indian friend, we are not only jala, but also very, very reliable jala. Right? Over 1,000 years, you see, Guru's own land, a lot of ups and downs. No? And modern India, I think, you see, too much pay attention about Western education. So, during those years, we, as a jala, kept all this knowledge intact. So it is sufficient proof we are quite a reliable jala, isn't it? Thank you. Thank you. Long time friend. Hello. Thank you, thank you. Could you pardon us?
He's taking a picture of the audience. He couldn't. So what I was telling, reading this, so although the science and technology, there's been a lot, tremendous advancement in the fields of science and technology, but we are also greatly distracted by the hustle and bustle of hectic lives. So if we talk about becoming good human beings and be compassionate and so forth, because these are taught in the religions, then from amongst the 7 billion people on this earth, over 1 billion people are not without any religious belief. For example, as I said yesterday, as I told you, Mao Zedong said at the end that religion is poison. But I also do make clear to people that Mao Zedong was a very intelligent and clever person, but later on he really held on to power and became very evil. But initially he was a very good socialist. So if Mao Zedong was still alive today, he may say that religion in general is poison, but he may say that Buddhism is something different. Most probably he would say that. As I said yesterday, if you understand Buddhist psychology and philosophy, then even those atheists who are against religion can be actually made dumbfounded. In 1957, around 1957, Wan Fuxian, who was a very good person of Chinese authority, named Famine. So I talked to him about past and future lives, and he said, no, there's no past and future. And I asked him why, and he said, we cannot see them. And then I asked him, is it necessary that if something exists that we should see them? And he said no. And so he lost. If we were debating, he lost in the debate. So I could say, you are done. So just because you cannot see something doesn't mean that it's... to have to say that something does not exist because you don't see it is something silly. So if you are able to understand the teaching through logic and reasoning, then you don't need to be fearful of anybody. You don't need to fear anyone. And so in our tradition, there is mention of an extremely hidden phenomena for which we actually resort to the authority of scriptures. But in order to be able to do that, you need to understand the mainstream teaching of the Buddha. For example, in the case of the slightly hidden phenomena regarding nirvana or liberation, it is something that is proved through reason that we can attain, that it's achievable and so forth. And therefore, when it comes to the main principle teaching that can be established through reasoning and logic, then we can infer them through reason, then we could also believe in the extremely hidden phenomenon as well. But having drawn conclusion through inference, by using reason, that's not enough. But what we need to develop further is the experiential knowledge. And therefore, we need to, when it comes to talking about experience, empirical experience of things, this is what science deals with. And so on the basis of what is obvious, then the scientists also check into the nature of things. And then they come to the conclusion saying that things have no objective existence. In quantum physics, they do say that. But when it comes to and to talk about the observer in the quantum physics, Buddhist philosophy can actually contribute to the understanding. And then in psychology also, to combat our negative emotions and so forth, we can learn a lot from Buddhist tradition. So quantum physics saying that nothing exists objectively can go in hand with the Buddhist philosophical understanding and as well. It is crucially important for all of us who follow the Buddha to develop a faith based upon an understanding of the Buddha's Dharma teaching. So as Buddhists, of course, we have faith in the Buddha. But we, on the basis of the following, the teaching means that we establish the two truths on the basis level and then prove that it is possible for us to attain cessation through the means of the true path. As I said yesterday, on the basis of the teaching of the four seals, which means all composite things are impermanent, all contaminated things or impure things are in the nature of suffering, that everything is selfless and empty, and that nirvana is peace. It's something that can, these are things that we can prove through reason. And so the Buddha, right in the beginning of his teaching, he taught the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths in 12 aspects, three times repeating them, the Four Noble Truths. And so first talking about the nature of the things, and then the function of the Four Noble Truths, and how to engage in discarding those practices which need to be avoided, and how to develop those principles that need to be adopted, and then accordingly how we reach the resultant stage of Buddhahood and Nirvana and so forth. So when you understand the teaching of the Buddha well through reason, then you will see that it's not easy to posit a creator God from the point of view of Buddhism. Because those religious traditions which believe in a creator God, that God is something permanent, unchanging, and God actually is a self-evolved without going through any process of transformation or anything like that, that is permanent. And so, since the Creator is believed to have come about without any causes and conditions, it's quite. It would also logically be true to say that what He created cannot happen because things change, and if it comes through something that doesn't change at all, it cannot happen. And so, when you actually check these kind of teachings through logic and reasoning, then you can see a lot of logical inconsistencies in this kind of thesis. So in that case, you would either have to say that there is no such creator, and then, since there is lots of suffering amongst sentient beings, but then on the other hand, the theistic religions say that God is infinite love. That also poses some logical inconsistency. And then it is also said that the God is almighty. And if that is the case, then He should be able to solve all the problems in the world. But by saying this, I'm not criticizing other religious traditions as such, but because there are many people who are benefited by these religious, theistic religious traditions, so you cannot say that what you believe in Creator God and so forth is totally wrong. But because by following their religion, they are benefited. And then I met one Indian sadhu who was actually feeding thousands of school children. In his ashram, he also has a kitchen where he has cooking meals for thousands of children in the different schools in South India, in Karnataka. So when I met him in his ashram, I told him that you, the Hindus, and us Buddhists, we have a shared practice of the three trainings of morality, training of concentration, and training of wisdom. So, of course, they also have the practice of the worldly penetrative insight. So I usually say that in Hindus and the Buddhists are like twin brothers or sisters. So as a Buddhist, what helps me is by thinking along the line of selflessness, whereas for you as a Hindu, idea of a self or Atman helps you better. So we have our own practices with regards to the philosophical concept of self and or selflessness. It's a personal practice and personal to ourselves. But we have a shared practice of the three trainings, I told him. And then in Holland, I gave a talk to the public during which I talked about the theistic and non-theistic religious traditions that exist in the world. And so after that, then during the question and answer session, one lady came forward, told me that thinking about theistic God, a creator, helps her a lot. And so I told her that that's very good, you should follow that. So those following the theistic religious traditions, I'm not criticizing them as such, but because in Buddhism we reject creator God, and also independent, an independent self. And from the point of view of Buddhism, we reject these ideas of self, independent self, and creator God. And then in Australia, there is one Christian minister who takes care of poor and homeless people, and also give education to street children. And so he has a soup kitchen. And one time, I gave a public talk, and he introduced me. In his introduction, he said, he pointed to me and his finger to me and said, he considered me as a good Christian. So serving others is a common practice for both of us, Christians and Buddhists. And then during my turn, I said that I consider you a good Buddhist. So I met him recently. He was very happy. So I really admire and appreciate such people. So as I said yesterday, philosophically, if we have to kick out those people who follow different philosophical schools, then we would have to kick out the Savatantrika Madhyamakas down to the Vaibhashikas within the Buddhist tradition, out of Buddhist philosophical tradition. But that cannot be done. You cannot do that with all the religious traditions because of the philosophical differences. What should bring us together is the shared practice, which is love and compassion. And so we share food. Therefore, 7 billion people on this earth should live in harmony with each other, in friendship, and help each other. And just because of some differences, we cannot reject others. So there's no use in doing that. Many of the problems in the world is because of this division that we create amongst people. So to counter this, we need to have the sense of sympathy with each other in good and bad times, to live together. So what I was saying is, from the point of Buddhism, we reject the idea of God, the creator, and also independent self. So for all of us who follow the Buddha to develop faith based upon the understanding of the Buddha's teaching, it is crucial. So by seeing, understanding the teaching through reason is what I mean. So, just as we should develop compassion on the basis of understanding through reason, likewise we should have faith through reason. And therefore, and so understanding based on reason, the faith based upon reason and understanding means that we need to be able to use our discernment. But for that, we need to be unbiased. Because if you are biased, thinking that, oh, my tradition is best, then you will not see the good qualities in other traditions, and you will not also see your own fault. But if you are unbiased, then you will see the qualities in others, good qualities in others, and your own faults as well. And therefore, unbiased attitude is very important. So unbiased is, so you should be unbiased. And then you should also be skeptical. And so in the 400 verses it mentions being intelligent. And then you should also have aspiration to practice. After having done the analysis into the teaching, whether for oneself or others, how to help oneself or others is what you should think. And what are those things which bring harm and ruin to oneself and others should also be understood. And so you should be able to have the aspiration to help others, benefit others. And therefore, these are the three qualities of a listener that Ayurveda gives: unbiased, inquisitive, and aspirant. And therefore, we should be investigate them by analyzing and inquiring with an unbiased, inquisitive mind. So you should be unbiased to check into the teachings, whether they are Buddhist or non-Buddhist traditions. And you should have the skeptical, inquisitive, skeptical mind to, in order to be able to do analysis into the teaching. As I said, quoted Buddha's statement where the Buddha said, "O monks and scholars, just as a gold is tested by rubbing, cutting, and burning, likewise you should examine my teaching and then accept it." So just as a goldsmith tests the quality of gold by burning, cutting, and rubbing, therefore, and likewise, you should check the teaching of the Buddha, and if you see the reason, there's reason for these teachings, you should follow it. And then within the teaching, there are those teachings which are provisional, which cannot be taken literally. So you should have the skeptical mind. And if we are to develop this faith that is supported by understanding, the understanding of works of the profound and the vast traditions composed by the masters are universally renowned, the six ornaments and two supreme ones, as well as others such as Buddha Palita and Arya Vimuktisena, are indispensable. With this in mind, I commissioned the painting of the Thangka depicting 17 of the most learned and accomplished masters of Nalanda, adding 9 other masters from the profound and the vast lineages to the traditional Thangka arrangement for the six ornaments and two supreme ones. Together with this, I felt inspired to compose a prayer such as this out of heartfelt devotion to these great learned masters and several of my sincere Dharma friends, which includes Trishik Rinpoche. And so he said that if you could compose such a text, it would be very good. So he supported me. So several of my sincere friends, Dharma friends, also encouraged me. So it was that I, the Buddhist monk Tenzin Gyatso, who has gained confidence and uncontrived faith in the excellent works of the learned masters of, and who belongs amongst the lowest of those who have studied their masterful compositions, who wrote this prayer to kindle the threefold faith, addressed to the 17 great apprentices of the Nalanda. So I'll not go through the text word for word, but give brief explanations. So in the beginning, the Buddha was the one who first taught and gave his teaching. When right after becoming enlightened, the Buddha said, "I have found this nectar-like dharma, or the truth, which is profound, peaceful, unfabricated, uncompounded, and clear light." So the Buddha went through the process of study and meditation and single-pointed concentration. And then, because of having gone through the process of collecting merit and wisdom over three countless eons through his practice, then because of the imprints that are left on his mind, in that life, through his practice, he was able to make all these manifest within himself, and then he was able to overcome all the defilements from within his mind and became someone who is purified of all negativities and full of knowledge of everything. And therefore, he said, this dharma, the nectar-like dharma that is found, is profound and so forth, which leads one to that nectar statement, the state of nectar, which means immortality of the nirvana. If I were to teach it to others, so he said that I have actually understood everything and that leads one to the process of leading an individual to that state of immortality or nirvana. But if I were to teach this to others, nobody will understand me. And so what this means is that if he taught what he discovered or what he realized, which is selflessness of self and others, nobody would understand it. And so for 49 days, the Buddha remained silent, and he said in this verse that, therefore, I'll remain silent in the forest. And so after having done the 6-year austerity practice and so forth, people have actually seen him, and when he found him to be somebody different from others, and therefore he was requested to give teaching to people, and therefore he began by teaching the Four Noble Truths in Varanasi. And so this is a teaching shared with that we share with Pali tradition as well. So both the Pali tradition, followers of Pali, and the Sanskrit tradition have this common teaching. And also we have the 37 practices or factors of enlightenment also common. And then after this first sermon of the Buddha, then the Buddha elaborated and gave detailed teaching, more detailed teaching on true cessation in his second turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is the teaching of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras in Rajagriha. So in the concentration, King of Concentration Sutra or somewhere, it is said that teaching of emptiness is taught, and Master Nagarjuna summarizes the teachings on emptiness from different sutras, and he wrote the fundamental wisdom verses of the middle way, Mula Madhyamaka Karika, and which teaches that of the reality of dependent origination of things. So, His Holiness is going over this text the prayer to rekindle, to kindle the threefold faith. First, the verse is in homage to the Buddha, where he says, perfectly arisen through the compassionate wish to benefit beings, and more exalted even than the gods, and then guide of beings to liberation, and you guide beings to liberation through teaching dependent origination. And then amongst the disciples of the Buddha, there were humans, of course, many different human beings, and then there were deities also amongst his audience. So, for example, in the case of the Heart Sutra, we find this in the fashion of a dialogue between Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara. And so amongst the Buddha's disciples, there were deities as well. And particularly, we usually mention the 8 close Bodhisattva disciples. And then human disciples like Subhuti and Shariputra and Supath. So in such a gathering, the Buddha taught in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, explicitly he taught emptiness. So when we talk about emptiness, it is not a standalone kind of a quality that we can talk without relation to some object. So emptiness has to be established on something. Without that, there is no standalone emptiness without some object on which we could actually prove that, which we could prove emptiness. And apart from that, there is no emptiness. So on the basis of an object, which becomes the basis to establish emptiness, we have this quality called emptiness, which is established on that object. And so, in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, the basis or the object on which emptiness is established are the five aggregates, and then the path system of the bodhisattvas and so forth, and then the resultant stage realizations of the Buddha. And therefore, in the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, the Buddha taught explicitly emptiness. And then implicitly, what he has dealt with are the progression along the path. And so the explicit content of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings was explicated by Master Nagarjuna with the help of Manjushri, who passed on this profound teaching lineage. And Master Nagarjuna's writings, like the six collection of reasonings, are marvelous texts. So this is a text that the daily sustenance for me to think about emptiness. And I really I recite verses from it and then reflect on the deeper meaning, and this really helps in transforming me. And then the implicit content of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras was, which is the progressing along the path system, was made clear or explained by Maitreya in his Abhisamaya Alamkara, and we have what are known as the five treatises of Maitreya. And study of the Perfection of Wisdom, which is known as Parchino, Perfection of Wisdom teachings, is done in Tibet for many years. And so we have the root text, Abhisamaya Alamkara, and then commentaries written by Indian masters such as Haribhadra, who also wrote the Sphuta Artha, the clear meaning commentary. And then there are many sub-commentaries to these Indian masters' texts, or this particularly Haribhadra's clear meaning, written by Tibetan masters as well. And then with regard to the profound lineage, we have Master Nagarjuna and his disciples such as Aryadeva, Buddha Palita, Chandrakirti, and so forth. These Madhyamaka masters who have written many different texts. And then also in Tibet, Tibetans also took very intense interest in the study of Madhyamaka philosophy. And it is said that Rendawa particularly took interest in, he was the force behind the spread of Madhyamaka philosophical tradition and study of Madhyamaka philosophy in Tibet, it is said. In Kunsang Pelden's writing, it is said that since the time of Rendawa, because the study of Madhyamaka treatises became so prevalent, there was this saying that people think about Madhyamaka, they're reflecting on Madhyamaka, whether they're sitting, walking, or resting. And so Randhawa must have been the one of the primary force behind the spread of the study of Madhyamaka tradition. And so there had been many pattern great masters of the different religious traditions who have taken great interest. So there are thousands of writings of the great masters of the past on Madhyamaka. And then next is Aryadeva. Next comes Buddha Palita. So Aryadeva has actually done lots of critical analysis and investigation into the different philosophical systems that existed that were extant at that time. And then next comes Buddha Palita. There is the Buddha Palita's writing, which is called Buddha Palita, which is a commentary to the Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Nagarjuna. It is a very good commentary, not very long. So I sometimes do teach this text. And then next comes, next verse is refers to the great master Bhavviveka. So if you look at his writings, like the Heart of the Middle Way and its commentary, the Blades of Reasoning, you'll find him to be really an excellent great scholar. So as I said, mentioned yesterday, he mentions, he said in his text that Asanga and Vasubandhu were shameless to interpret the teaching of the Buddha. Different from Nagarjuna's tradition. So in his commentary to Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is called The Lamp of Wisdom, he criticizes Buddha Palita for using certain style of logic at absurdum, reductio ad absurdum logic. And if he had not done that, then Chandrakirti may not have come to defend Buddha Palita and made the position of the Prasangikas clear. And so he was really a great scholar. Acharya Bhavviveka, to you I pray. And then next comes Chandrakirti. You developed and elaborated upon the complete path of sutra and tantra. So he was a master of both sutras and tantras. So regarding tantra, Nagarjuna has written the five stages, and also which is a text on this completion stage. And then he also wrote Dorje. Which is about generation stage. And then, as a commentary to Master Nagarjuna's text, Aryadeva wrote the Charyamelapaka. And then Chandrakirti wrote another commentary on the five stages, which is called the Sherab Dremen, or Devadrensel, or the Pradhipodyutana, of bright light. So Master Chandrakirti, in his Madhyamaka Avatara, Introduction to Buddha, the Middle Way, says that things do not have any objective independent existence, but they exist by way of conventional designation. So if the quantum physicists hear this, they would be happy. Otherwise, the Chittamatras have problem when they say, I mean, because they say that things do not have any objective external existence at all, but their mind or cognition has some independent existence. So we usually, in the study of primer, logic primer, collective topics, we usually define existence as that which is the object of cognition, a valid cognition. And so, with regard to the Chittamatras, the mind on the school, they say that everything that exists is a reflection of the mind. And they use the reason that things such as the object blue and the subjective mind, which is the cognition of the blue, they arise simultaneously. And because of that, the blue color does not exist, is not a substantially separate phenomena than the cognition of it. And so quantum physicists also have a similar kind of idea. But if you understand that, I mean, in order to do away with the problem of this kind of thesis, if you understand that things are merely designated, although things do have external existence, they do not exist by way of their own power, but merely by way of they exist by way of designation. So, if you could understand this well, then you don't have to, you won't have the difficulty that the Chittamatras have, because who say that things cannot, since things cannot be found, when you analyze and try to find the identity by searching for the identity of a thing in the object, then they say they do not exist externally. And then next comes Master Shantideva, who wrote the two texts, the Compendium of Practices and the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. So these two texts complement each other. What is not so clear and elaborate in one text is found more clear and elaborately in the other. And so they supplement each, complement each other. And so it was written in the 8th century. Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, or the Way of the Bodhisattvas. Since it was written in the 8th century, there has not been a greater text for the cultivation of the spirit of enlightenment, altruistic spirit of enlightenment, no greater text than this. So far, what we have done is considered self-cherishing attitude to be so important to us, whereas Master Shantideva makes it very clear that this, this has its own faults and defects, and how to cultivate cherishing others over oneself through reasons and logic. And then next comes Master Chandrakshita, who aligned with whose philosophical assertion aligns with that of Chittamatra on the one hand, saying that things have no external existence, while also accepting the Madhyamaka philosophy, saying that things have no true existence as well. And so he combines these two philosophical traditions. So founder of the tradition which skillfully combines Madhyamaka and Pramana, teaching the middle way path of twofold the non-dual emptiness according to the capacity of the disciples. and introducing the Buddha's teaching to the land of snows. Great Abbot Chandrakchita, to you I pray. So the tradition that we have, this great tradition of Nalanda monastic institution, where we have the study of the treatises through reason, is thanks to Master Chandrakchita. Minling Lochen has written a praise to the Guru Padmasambhava, then Chandrakchita, and the king, Tisong Detsen. So in this prayer, he actually praises Chandrakchita first, and then the Master Padmasambhava, and then Tisong Detsen. So he was the principal person in the establishment of teaching of Buddha on the Tibetan soil. And then next comes Kamala Shila, who was the student of Chandrakchita from Nalanda Monastic Institution, and at the prophesied by the Chandrakchita, or as told by Chandrakchita, he was invited to Tibet. So there were in Chinese practitioners in Samye Monastery, the first Buddhist monastery established at that time. In it, there was also a department of meditation, which is called the Chinese practitioners were living in this department called the Unwavering Concentration Department. So the Chandrakchita actually acknowledged the practice of meditation, and then these Chinese practitioners were living there. But later, some of these Chinese practitioners began to assert the thesis there of non-thinking. And so since they say that mere meditation, Singapore meditation is sufficient, we don't need to do a lot of analytical meditation or checking into the teachings and study. And then Kamala Shila was invited in order to challenge them, and therefore he won the debate against them. And then he wrote the three books of Stages of Meditation, the initial, the medium, intermediate, the middle, and the third book. And he also wrote Madhyamaka Aloka, the light of Madhyamaka, or lamp of Madhyamaka. And then he also wrote two volumes of In the Kanjur. There are these two volumes, which are the commentaries to his master Chandrakchita's Tattva Samgraha, the Compendium of Reality. And so in this, he writes that on the basis of understanding causality, law of causality, we created causes for higher rebirth, and on the basis of understanding the dependence in terms of designation, we created causes for liberation. And so he was a top scholar of India at that time who came to Tibet. So you brilliantly set out the stages of meditation according to both Sutra and Tantra, combining the view of middle way beyond extremes with the unity of Samatha and Vipassana, and clearly revealed the unmistaken teaching of the Buddha in the land of snows. Noble Kamala Shila, to you I pray. So up to this, we have the profound lineage view of lineage. And then comes Asanga, who was the founder of the Chittamatra philosophical tradition. And then next is his younger brother, Vasubandhu. And after Vasubandhu comes Dignaka, who was a great scholar of logic and epistemology, who wrote Pramana Samuchaya, Compendium of the Epistemology. and also wrote a commentary to the 8,000 verses of Panchaparamita. And he is followed by Dharmakirti, Acharya Dharmakirti. And his text, Pramanavartika, the valid commentary to the valid cognition, and is a text that is studied in the monastic learning institutions of Tibet. And next comes Vimuktisena. Arya Vimuktisena was a student of Vasubandhu. Nevertheless, as Haribhadra says, Vimuktisena interpreted Abhisamaya Alamkara according to the Madhyamaka philosophical understanding and not following Chittamatra philosophy as like his own master, Vasubandhu. And he found that Vasubandhu's interpretation of Abhisamaya Alamkara ornament for clear realization and its source text, the Panchaparamita, did not accord with reality. And so he interpreted it from the point of view of Madhyamaka philosophy. So you said a light lamp which illuminates the text of ornament of realization and the meaning of transcendental wisdom passed down by Asanga and his brother in accordance with the Madhyamaka tradition beyond extremes of existence and not existing. Arya Vimuktisena, at your feet I pray. And with regard to the Vinaya, the monastic discipline, or the code of discipline, the tradition that is followed in Tibet is called the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, whereas in the Pali tradition in Thailand and other countries, they follow the Theravada tradition. So with regard to these two Vinaya tradition, so with regard to certain secondary infractions of monastic vows, there are 70 counted in the Pali, the Theravada tradition. They also have these vows of the referred to as the four defeats and then the 13 remainders and so forth, which are also same in our tradition, Mula Sarvastivada tradition. And then the mere infraction are counted as 90, not 92. And then with regard to the secondary infractions, in the Pali tradition, there's mention of only one each in relation to the upper garment and lower garment. But in the Sanskrit tradition that we follow, regarding the upper garment, there are three or ways of wearing it, and then seven ways of avoiding, how to wear. Seven are mentioned, that it should not be the lower garment, the skirt should not be worn too high above the knee or too low below the ankle, and not too tightly around the body, and not folding too low from the top and so forth. So there are seven ways of wearing, seven faults of wearing the skirt. And after Vimuktisena comes Haribhadra, and then we have Gunaprabha, so and Shakyaprabha, and then lastly the 17th master is Cho Atisha, who was very kind to refine or reform the teaching of the Buddha in the Land of Snows. And then after that, what I've written is, May I be blessed so that I plant the foundation of the path to freedom. May I understand the fundamental nature of reality and the meaning of the two truths. So the two truths, the conventional and ultimate truths, are the basis, the level truth. As Madhyamaka Avatara by Chandrakirti says, that there are two aspects to everything. One is the conventional existence of things, and the other is the ultimate reality of it. And so these two reside on the same object, but they are different conceptually. And gain uncertainty about the four truths and how samsara is perpetuated and discontinued, and through valid cognition develop stable and lasting faith in the three jewels. So by one should understand on the basis of understanding the two truths, then on the basis of that we should understand what is meant by dependent origination, how things come about through dependence, and understand the working of causality, and then on the basis of that, although cessation itself, true cessation, is not a product as such, but on the through the path, the true path, true cessation is brought about within ourselves. So the Buddha says suffering must be known and the origin of suffering must be overcome. So, suffering here does not refer merely to suffering of suffering, the obvious painful experiences we know as undesired, and those changeable suffering, but the deeper suffering, which is called the pervasive conditional existence suffering. And this is referred in Pramanavartika as in relation to the five psychophysical aggregates within samsara, the samsaric existence. And then, origin of suffering, the root of all the negative emotions and suffering and so forth is ignorance, which is eliminated by understanding some emptiness. So this verse also relates to the taking refuge, that one's practice of refuge would be really authentic and pure. May I be blessed so that I come to master uncontrived bodhicitta together with its root, a mind of renunciation seeking the goal of perfect enlightenment, in which all forms of suffering and their causes are thoroughly pacified, and a compassionate wish to protect all beings as limitless as space itself. May I be blessed so that I arrive easily at the definitive understanding. And were the supreme sources of all the profound points of paths of transcendent perfection vehicle and the Vajrayana, through studying, reflecting, and meditating upon the meaning of the great pioneering master's classic works. And so, in order for our tantric practice to be effective and successful, we need to actually found ourselves on the teachings, the mainstream teaching of the Sutrayana, the perfection vehicle. And so the 17 Nalanda masters are very close to our heart as Tibetans, because we study their writings. When we think about Nagarjuna, immediately it gives the idea of the Mula Madhyamaka Karika to us, and we could actually think about who he is. And then the other masters, like Asanga and his disciple and his brother and the followers. So these teachings of the The Nalanda, 17 Nalanda masters were passed down to us by Master Chandrakshita when he established the teaching of the Buddha. He actually brought to us the tradition of these masters. So just as he passed this tradition to us, we have done really well in keeping up with the teaching of the Buddha. So until now, we have preserved this teaching, which comprised the study of psychology, logic, and epistemology, which could be considered as academic subjects, and by which we can actually serve the world. And then, next, we will have question and answer session.
Incorrect, wrong perception, direction of the middle. Wrong thinking.
Someone is just playing with the questioner, the boy who stood up to put the question, because he has rolled up his sleeves. His Holiness said, okay, now, earlier when the students were debating, they rolled up their sleeves. Now you roll up your sleeves and ask your question. The question is, some people don't accept religion, don't believe in religion, but they have good heart. Second question is, there's a lot of changes going on in technology, but human beings are not so much changing. And why is that so? The question is again, those some people don't believe in religion, but they practice good heart. What is the reason? Answer is, even if you don't believe in religion, you don't, but if you practice good heart, for such kind of person, you know, religious people cannot say, I beg you to practice, believe in religion, or you cannot bully them to follow, believe in religion. It's their own freedom. So there are billions of people in this world, and everybody has their own right to thought and pursuit of happiness. So it's up to them. But good heart is very important. So for everybody. So how to do that? There are two ways. One, by believing in some sort of a creator, father figure. And the other way is by trying to exercise logic and reduce negative thoughts and increase positive thoughts. So these, His Honor says, we have been sort of discussing about how Buddhism teach that. So if one, according to the text, in order to achieve personal happiness, personal well-being, there's nothing greater than bodhicitta mind. It's the greatest method to achieve happiness for oneself and for all sentient beings. Just like that, that prayer, I generate bodhicitta mind, and for the sake of all sentient beings attain Buddhahood, and I engage in the practices of the bodhisattva path in order to serve all sentient beings. And now, So now, you don't have to, in this, here we don't have to talk about whether one practice, whether one accepts the inherent self or not, or whether one has belief in religion or not. But now when one goes deeper, then the question arises as to what is the ultimate nature of phenomena. Whether there is inherent nature or not, there is no inherent nature. So His Honest says, did my answer responded to your question? Next question. In 2001, I joined the transit school, Sherab Katselin. I paid attention to the Indian yoga tradition, Rishikesh. There's an academy there, and I got admission, and I'm going there soon. So when I was in Tibet, I went to school, and then after... So it looks like there's a lot of connection between the Indian yoga system and the Tibetan wind and channel practice. Now the difference is in the Tibetan practice, traditional practice of wind and channel, you have to first receive initiation empowerment, whereas in the Indian yoga system, which is taught in Rishikesh, they don't ask you to receive initiation and empowerment like that. I'm guessing. So the Indian yoga system is sort of spread, taught all over the world, whereas the Tibetan tradition is kept secret and not being made widespread among the public. So why not? Why can't we, the Tibetan secret tradition, be also made sort of public so that everyone can avail of this opportunity? His Honest says, it depends on the purpose of learning yoga. If the purpose is to attain enlightenment and to practice the wind and channels and to awaken the more subtle minds and dissolve the more gross minds and gross energy into the clear light. So in such practice, we have this six yogas of Naropa. So this is the. So here we have this. In this system, so it is important to receive the empowerment, and then also to observe the commitments of the empowerment. So here, the main target is to meditate on the emptiness of the clear light mind. Now, this is something not everyone can do. Now, the yoga that you talk about very widespreadly, this seems to be more targeted for physical well-being. So there is no harm in that. Now, even if in the six yogas Naropa, if there are some aspects that can be appropriated for physical well-being, I think there's not much harm in that. Maybe that's okay to popularize this those aspects from the Tibetan tradition and make them public. The next person, he begins his question by paying his homage to His Holiness. First he says he has a request for His Holiness. I always believe in my mother. Mother is very important for us, and her kindness is so great. So we always pray that all mother sentient beings, all mother sentient beings live long and have a good life and have for their well-being. So I request Your Holiness to please pray for all sentient beings. His Holiness says, that's very good. His Holiness says, tomorrow, if there's time, prospecting on giving an empowerment of doing a Bodhicitta generation ceremony. We have in our Tibetan tradition, even in our daily prayers, to say all mother sentients be well and safe. So we, even in our daily practice, it is in our culture that we say that all sentient beings, we have been our mothers in past life, and we feel concern for them. Now, bodhicitta is a practice which is rooted in the practice of compassion. And compassion is a mind which feels that may other sentient beings be separated from suffering, and may I try to I wish to save them, you know, free them from their suffering. This is sort of compassion which wanted to protect sentient beings. So this is explained in the Uttara Tantra Yulama through nine analogies and nine meanings like that. Now, in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the fourth one, the third one, succession of afflictive emotion. If we understand well that, then if we think well on that, then we can understand that afflictive emotion and suffering are only adventitious and could be eliminated through conditioning. And also that we are subject to progress and eventually complete cessation of all afflictive emotion, together with obscuration could be eliminated and enlightenment could be attained. So these are these experiences come in high Soka Tantra. So it's very good that you have such thoughts, and now I encourage you to pay more attention and continue to think on this, and try to get a deeper understanding of what the meaning of secession, the truth of secession, the third truth, which says awaken the secession, truth of secession. This will help you. So here, as an understanding of selflessness is required. If there is no understanding of selflessness, it's a little bit difficult. Whereas if you have a good grounding on emptiness, selflessness, then the truth of secession and its meaning will become will reveal itself. So learning and contemplation, these two must be combined. This is very important. So learning and introspection. Dhammadharma has said that when I learn, I contemplate. When I learn, I meditate. So I do these three things simultaneously. So this is very important. So next question. Next question. Prostrations to His Holiness. Then we as students and humble people, how to next future lives be born as a good human being, well versed in both Dharma as well as in worldly matters. His Holiness says, Dharma practice doesn't mean changing your robes, costume. There's no difference between whether you are a man or a woman, or ordained or not lay. So learning and well educated is very important. The social development is very important. I consider the development of society as very fundamental. Therefore, I consider the lay community extremely important because they comprise the society. So if society has developed well, progressed well in a positive way, so they can educate their children from young age in their culture, in their religious, in their spiritual culture, Dharma, like that. So therefore, I, even in South India, in the big monastery, I used to tell that the real Dharma holder, the real people, the community which can hold up the Dharma is the lay community, the society, which consists primarily of the lay population. Such a society can uphold the Dharma, can also support the Sangha. So, whereas on the other hand, if the Sangha society itself has not much not much interest in Dharma, then only a small group of Sangha try to practice Dharma, it is not a very lasting situation. So therefore, that is the reason why I always say lay people should learn the Dharma, Buddhist philosophy, and should learn debate and logic like that. Next question. Buddhism, it is said that Buddhism is related to mental development. And the rays of the sun, the Buddha Dharma spreads all over the the light of Dharma shines in all the four directions. So if that is the case, where is the karsa? Where is the mind? In the brain or in the body? His Holiness says, you have to make a distinction between the gross and the subtler minds. Now, the five sense organs, consciousnesses, they are based on the sense organs. Because they are development or their generation is empowered by the organs. Now, as regards the mental consciousness, which comes in the aftermath of a previous sense organ. Sense consciousness is also a resultant a causal sense consciousness. Now, the mental consciousness has various types. mental consciousness which is awake there, which is there when during daytime when you are awake simultaneously with the sense consciousness. Then in sleep state there is a gross mental mind. Then when the mind becomes even deeper, like the dream state, there's a subtle, there's a more subtle mind. I have seen that myself. When a person is in deep sleep, there's still some kind of activity in the brain, and then they say, okay, the person's going through a dream. Then you can say the person is going through in a very deep state of sleep. So these different levels of mental consciousness are connected to the brain. Now, so these consciousness are related to this physical body of this life, which when a person dies, the blood circulation stops, and the blood stops running to the brain, and then the person has died. Simultaneously, some people after death still continues to remain fresh, and some people have even recovered, come back from death. So these are also signs that there's a subtle mental activity apart from the gross minds that we are able to recognize. Now, the gross mind that are directly related to this body have a beginning and an end, which begins with the birth and ends with the death. Now, where's mind? This mind. Now, according to as doctors say, it is really in the brain. Where you can change the heart, but you cannot change the brain. As so far, this has not happened. But we have a saying. We say, in the center of my heart, as if the mind is sort of residing there. Now, when we talk about the chakras, which is related to the central channel, the Umma, Avaduti. And now the mind sort of energy flows up and down, and simultaneously the mind flows in up and down. Now you cannot really sort of reject the existence of this, the truth of this thing. Because when a meditator meditates, they can have the experiences. At the same time, they are not exactly these descriptions are not exactly in accordance with the scientific explanation. And also there are the explanations given in Kalachakra and Guhya Samaja are also slightly different in terms of how the mind springs up, or rather awakens. So this body, the gross minds is directly related to this body. And when the body dies, these gross minds also die. However, there is a more subtle mind, which is the primal cause or the primal source of these gross minds. And so now, if you say this primal cause is related to the body, then it's difficult. That is something difficult. Now, it must be that primal source mind should come from a more subtle previous source, substantial cause. Because we have a saying, in the Pramana Vartika, a physical object, substance, can never be a cause to a consciousness, subtle consciousness. A subtle consciousness must be caused by a previous substantial previous consciousness. So now, what is this primal subtle consciousness? Now, if you are a believer in a creator, you can say God created. So now, on the other hand, if you wanted to sort of follow logic, so there must be a continuity of this primal consciousness. So so there's no according to logic, this subtle mind comes from beginningless time. There's no beginning. So therefore, so this very subtle mind, the answer for its nature and its beginning or its cause like that is available in Tantra only. And there's no beginning and there's no end. Next question. When we human beings don't do some negative action, we create a sin. And small insects also eat a smaller insect. Do they also get a bad karma out of that? So his audience's answer is that now with regard to karma or action, there are different categories. Action you have committed, but you have not, but no result. Then you have committed an action, but without motivation. You didn't really do it, but you committed. So, like, if there's an insect on the back of your neck, if you just do unknowingly, you know, blow it away with your hand, and the insect dies, you have no intention to kill it, but it got killed. Like that. And also, and then you there's some kind of, let's say, something like another insect, or you try to chase it, and you wanted to kill it, but the insect runs away into a hole and it escapes. So your intention was you wanted to kill, but you couldn't kill it. So main thing is motivation is very important. If you have the motivation, then the negative karma is bigger. So most important, the most important thing is motivation. So always have practicing love and compassion, and always now resolving not to harm other beings. Just like this action, you didn't do it, but you committed it like that. However, if you have strong intention, but you couldn't, you haven't killed it, still due to the strong motivation, you created a karma. So bad karma and good karma is not just a question of whether Buddha taught it, said it or not. It's just really a law of nature. An action that causes negative result is negative action. An action that leads to positive result is a positive action. So that's the main criteria. Do you, His Holiness asked this boy, do you kill insects? Sometimes His Holiness says, mosquitoes disturb you. Sometimes you are forced to kill a mosquito because you are in a very good deep sleep, and a mosquito keeps on hovering upon you and makes this sound, buzzing sound, and then you feel very disturbed and you kill it with your hand. When I was small, I remember throwing stones at animals or insects or like that. But after I become big, I don't hardly remember ever doing that. So if you practice the 10 virtuous actions, that is done mainly to protect yourself from negative consequences. But if you abstain from negative actions out of compassion and bodhicitta mind, it is not for you out of personal motivation, but rather in order to protect those sentient beings. So even though both actions refrain from negative actions due to the difference in the motivation, there's a big difference in the consequence. Next question. In our dreams, and sometimes in dreams we sometimes go to a place where we have never been, and then later on in real life we happen to actually visit that place we have dreamt in the place. Regarding dream, in Chudu, it is explained that it depends on people's physical body, like what kind of physical disposition you have, like earth, water, fire, like that. So depending on that, somehow plays a role. Some people get a very clear dream. Some people can dream the future. For example, some of my friends, when they were, even before coming to Tibet, when they were in Tibet, they had dreamt of Dharamsala. They had dreamt of Dharamsala in Tibet when they were in Tibet. So later on, when they came to Dharamsala, they remembered that they have actually already seen Dharamsala in their dream. So this is because the mind has become subtler, and these subtle minds can have some kind of a power to see the future. For example, in my case, when I'm awake, I cannot remember past lives. But in my dreams, sometimes I remember my past life. For example, let me tell you one story. In one of my dreams, I remember that in one time I was during the Pharaoh's time in Egypt. The Pharaoh was sitting there on a sort of a pedestal, very high building, just like in these pictures. I was there at the bottom of the pedestal, facing up to him as his prisoner facing up to him. And I was having a lot of fear. And then the king ordered to the guards to release me. So I remember something like that. Sometimes I remember, I dreamt of Indian masters, and sometimes ancient Tibetan masters in my dreams. I dream that I was there with them. So it's due to the fact that the mind has become subtler. Even among my friend meditators, the gross minds have sort of become dissolved, and the subtler mind has become more clear. So this is in real sort of space-time happened to many people among my meditative friends and some other people. So this is an area we have to continuously engage in dialogue with neuroscientists, neurobiologists. For example, there are people who can remember their past lives, not in dreams, even in real awakened, an awakened state. We have to now sort of do research, how this is possible. It is even me. When I was a little boy, it was said that I remembered very clearly. Remembered my past life. My mom told me. My mother told me this, and when Kesar Rinpoche, the leader of the search party, came to our home, that morning, my mother, it was said that I was very excited even before the delegation arrived, and I woke up early, and then the delegation, as the delegation entered, I immediately recognized the leader of the delegation, leader Kesar Rinpoche. I then immediately went to him and talked to him and said that the mala he was wearing around his neck was mine, and wanted it back. So such things happened. Now, right these days, I don't even remember what happened yesterday. Now, among you children, are there anyone who can, in their dream, recognize that you are in a dream state? It sometimes happens to me. I can recognize that I am in a dream state. And so, if you can remember that, then if you can, hello. If you have this ability, then it is good if you can utilize that dream state to practice some positive things. Positive things, because this is called dream yoga. It is said that the positive actions that you can commit, like practice you can do in dream state, are more powerful than practices you can do in awake state. Sometimes some people do like write the word Miller's dream, write on big sort of posters and stick them on the walls around the room, and then if you go to sleep, and that helps a little bit in remembering that you are in a dream state. And then when you are in your sleep, if the eyelid is slightly moving, if a friend can at that moment sort of tell you in a low voice, you are having dream. This is also one way of sort of helping. To let you know about that you are in a state of dream, and then do practice in sleep. So that's it for today, and His Honor says we will meet tomorrow again.